Welcome, ladies, gentlemen, and hermaphrodites, fellow slaves of the global plantation. The Vinny Eastwood Show is bad news. It's like the news, but worse. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't enjoy it. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinny Eastwood Show, where the only thing worse than living in a high-tech global police state run by child trafficking Satanists is Vinny's jokes. Welcome to another exciting episode, ladies and gentlemen. I have a very special guest waiting in the wings, Mr. Paul Abramowitz, and we'll be coming to him in just a few moments here. In the meantime, just a quick update on the Vinny Eastwood Show. Last night we were at the River of Lies, a premiere in Auckland here, a little documentary that my mate Billy TK, who I was arrested with 2 years ago, and we still haven't had our trial finished, by the way, and it's costing a hell of a lot of money, so donate at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and riveroflies.co.nz to just sort of expose the things that are going on with the so-called pandemic. So please go and show your support. There'll be screenings around the country upcoming, and maybe even a tour with me and Billy, Mrs. Permission permitting. Now, my very special guest, Paul Abramowitz, is with us here today, live in the middle of the night, thanks to time zones from South Africa, and I'm very grateful to have him here. Paul, welcome to the frickin' broadcast, mate.
Thank you, Vinny. Damn good to be with you.
I get that a lot. Now, could you please tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
So, I think the part of what I do that you're interested in is I've just completed a book which I wish I would have found many years ago, which is covering the sexual hardwiring of the male brain, particularly the heterosexual male brain. I am trained as a periodontist as well, the medical science of oral surgery, and completed a PhD in human sexuality some years ago. Was involved for a long time in men's consciousness work and discovered a missing part of the conversation, both in the therapeutic spaces, developmental spaces, workshop spaces, and that is how it is that we manage as men once we become sexed and become designed, shall we say, by biology to become reproducers for the species.
Sorry, guys, I had my mic on mute there. So how exactly does that break down? Could you really just give it to us from the beginning?
Yeah, so we are designed in utero, let's say 6 weeks in utero, with the first splash or tsunami of testosterone, which begins to differentiate the male and female body. And there are a number of splashes of testosterone as we move towards puberty, but essentially the male brain becomes ready to receive the final tsunami of testosterone at about the age of 13. And so we have a increase in number of neurons in the brain. We have a increase in the speed which these neurons transmit messages, and we have a pruning that happens at about the age of 26. But while all of our brains are busy developing as young men, we're also pressed towards a sexual tension. The semen or the sperm needs to get to the egg, and in a female physiology there is a very predictable way in which the egg comes into the fallopian tube. But biology, or what I call our reproductive biology intelligence has to get the sperm out. And what I noticed is that there are a number of behaviors that are cross-cultural and trans-historical that we as men, and particularly heterosexual men, have been identified as being able to blend into or become as we go through puberty and move into our adolescence and 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And that's because we are driven towards heightened and frequent, more intense sexual desire as young boys. And so we are driven to masturbate two or three times a day. We are driven to fantasies, as I mentioned, and to ejaculation. And all of that tends to create deep grooves in our consciousness, awareness. And when we come to the age of 26, none of that gets pruned away. Everything that we haven't used gets pruned away. And we are left with essentially the adolescent markings of a sexed being. That impacts our consciousness, our awareness. It impacts every aspect of our values, our behavior, our beliefs, and our attitudes, and certainly behaves the way that we connect with women. I call it a holographic hypersexual hyperspace that we are literally born into at that age during puberty.
So what do you actually think is the cause of this? You say it's just the testosterone, it's just a natural cycle?
Absolutely, absolutely. So we live in a pretty phenomenal biological being. There are 40 to 50 trillion cells that operate automatically in us. And there are 12 systems in our body, you know, our lymphatic system, our cardiovascular system, respiratory system, etc. But our reproductive system is the only system in our body that actually requires another body to live its full potential. And biology doesn't leave anything up to our discretion to a degree to make sure that the sperm to egg opportunity happens. And for women, this predictability has been pretty well delineated in terms of the menstrual cycle, the formation of the egg, and the dropping of the egg into the fallopian tube. But the sperm needs to get there. And so if we look at some very important studies, one in particular from 2001 by a fellow called Roy Baumeister, he looked at 156 studies which show that men do in fact have more frequent, more intense sexual desire, that we fantasize more about sex, we tend towards masturbation more, we action more towards sex as an outcome, we find it more difficult to say no to sex. And regarding actual sexual engagement, we prefer more sexual partners, we tend to. I must be clear here, I talk about tendencies and not generalizations. It's important to recognize, not to generalize, that there are some women who fall into the sphere of men and there are some men who fall into the sphere of women. So my point is that the reproductive biological intelligence creates an environment where we fall into the type of indices that Baumeister is talking about. However, in order to fulfill biology's role, our attitudes, values, behaviors, and beliefs also have to be impacted. And these are the lesser spoken about aspects of our persona as men and as young men, which are taken into account in the workshop space, in the therapy space. In other words, what I discovered from having been involved in transformational work for almost 15 years with hundreds of men is that a large chunk of our awareness is our sexual awareness. So biology not only determines our sexual reality, but our entire reality sexually. And that's part of the hardwiring conversation that hasn't really happened, or at least I found it not to have happened For the men in the middle of the bell curve, the non-perpetrators, the non-erectile dysfunction, the non-premature ejaculation, and the non-asexual men. The regular guys in the middle of the bell curve who are looking for ways to bring their sexual awareness up, to bump it up, to up-level it to a place where they've up-leveled their general other awareness like mindfulness or qigong or yoga or whatever mechanism that we use to grow and develop as men. The sexual consciousness conversation has not been had. And it's important that if that is a road that a man chooses, that we understand that we live in a body that is designed in a way to distract us sexually and to take our attention elsewhere and to, frankly, at certain times of our life, make us do crazy things.
When we're talking about sex, it's used in so many forms, including as a weapon. And
yeah,
because of the power, I was having a conversation with some guys the other day, and they were talking about the differential in men and women's power regarding sex. And a man who is a billionaire has worked for a very long time. He might be pretty old, and he has a similar amount of power as an 18-year-old woman who could control him with sex, right?
Yes.
There's not an even differential of power. And by the time that 18-year-old woman gets to her 30, her power goes down and down and down. And so there's a limited lifespan of sort of sexual appeal. One might call it an inequality, but I would just say it's a natural form of undulation that happens. And I think that if you are talking about sexual energy, how important is it to the survival of species to a degree, be contained? Because I think it was Jordan Peterson was talking about, in a society that does not have monogamy, then 20% of the men will get 80% of the women.
Yeah, I mean, let me come back to your first point, because it's a nice point. It's a nice point to make. It seems to be, and also what social media has done is create this term called high value individuals. And the men of high value are defined as being, you know, wealthy, successful. The women of high value are defined as being extremely attractive, like 12 out of 10s. And someone who's done a lot of work on this, a podcaster from Dubai, Sadia Khan, speaks beautifully about how these particular high value indices don't necessarily make for great relationships. And it's why a lot of relationships end after the first years, because these two types of so-called high value individuals don't necessarily blend into the group of people who communicate, who are compassionate, who are really looking to create long-term relationships. So I think, to your point, you will often see an older man with a very attractive woman, but you don't really see very attractive women with men that are not particularly successful. So there is perhaps a biological correlation that you can make there as well, and that is that the adolescent male sex brain is sort of left in place to some degree, because as I mentioned, at the age of 26, the brain is pruned. Whatever is not used is removed. Whatever is used, which is a lot of fantasy, a lot of tendency towards actioning towards sexuality, sex, is left behind. So a man tends to find younger women very attractive as he gets older. A woman is more or less biologically designed not only to be a sexual being, but also to be a nurturer. And so it feels like security is important for many women. And so they will often tend towards the men who are more financially stable. So there is a degree of biology that plays out to your first point. If you can explain your second point again, just to ask that question again about Jordan's point about monogamy.
He was talking about how in a society with no monogamy, that 20% of the men will get 80% of the women, and then you'll have 80% of men fighting over the last remaining 20% of the women, and there would be resentment and sort of chaos and things of that nature that really ensue. And he made the point that monogamous marriage and relationships is in many ways necessarily better for the man, better for the woman, and better for society. And how does these unconscious sexual sort of desires and fantasies and things of that nature play out? I mean, in France and in Japan, there's a culture whereby you kind of stop having sex with your man after you have marriage and have children, and it's permissible for them to go out and have mistresses and things of that nature. Whatever you're not getting at home, you will try and go get that elsewhere. So I'm just kind of like wondering about that dynamic as it plays psychologically, not only to the individual, but also to the wider whole. How do these cultures work and that kind of thing? I'm very curious about it.
Yeah. So I think it's useful to talk about monogamous relationships, and I would say that the generative, regenerative, passionate, and kind, compassionate, heterosexual monogamous relationship is quite rare, actually. It's a small percentage of the population, and I'm talking about after the honeymoon phase, Finny. So there is a tendency after the honeymoon phase, when the hormones reduce and the projections, you know, this person's going to save my life, reduce, reality sets in, that we tend to move towards wondering what else is going on outside of our relationship, or what else can somebody else bring me. So I think that the monogamous relationship, or the heterosexual one, is the kind one, and the functional one, and the passionate one, is a bit of a masterpiece and a bit of a rarity. If you look at divorce rates, you were asking how do some of our biological tendencies play into the fantasy or the hope of these monogamous relationships. In actual fact, my take on that is that these tend to disrupt the healthy monogamous relationship. Men tend to be distracted by what's outside of the relationship. I don't know if you know, but there's a place in our hypothalamus called the medium preoptic center, which is a mate spotting area. And already in 6 weeks in utero, that area is began to develop 2.5 times bigger than a woman's medium preoptic area. That means that we're far more likely to be distracted by something that's new and something that's exciting. And so theoretically,
sorry guys, we'll have to pick up that point just after the break. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on Republic Broadcasting. Prime suspect right here, the Vinnie and the Vendetta play.
Einstein once said, future medicine will be the medicine.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about getting your Luftwaffe aloft. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. And my very special guest is Paul Abramowitz, and we're talking about those things that usually don't get discussed outside of porn, really. Thank you very much for your time here, Paul, especially late in the evening. We've only got about another 37 minutes in the broadcast, so let's not waste too much time. Ladies and gentlemen, please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com/latest for the latest archives, and subscribe to the various channels that we have there, Rumble, Odyssey, and BitChute for those ad-free archives, rather than the live broadcast that we have here. So, Paul, welcome back. And we were talking about a monogamous relationship. So please continue.
Thanks, Vinny. Thanks, Vinny. So I think perhaps one of the challenging aspects of the monogamous relationship is that we've all grown up with a lot of fairy tales. So Hollywood, movies, poetry, music. You think about one of the love songs that you like to listen to, but you don't know actually that probably the chap that wrote it or the woman that wrote it may have broken up with their partner, you know, a week after they wrote it. So we're listening to, you know, ongoing melodies and lyrics of situations that are sometimes not sustainable and even sometimes not maintainable in the short term. And the way that impacts us from a very young age makes us look towards unrealistic outcomes and expect the other, our partner, to be our everything, to bring us absolutely all in a form of some codependence or whatnot. So unbundling ourselves from these narratives, I call it the relationship industrial complex or the relationship and sex industrial complex, because those who are selling things know what it is that we're very willing to buy. The problem is that in real terms, in a more sustained way, it really becomes past the honeymoon phase. It becomes a far more challenging space and a space where each partner is invited to do some work on themselves. And often that's where people tend to duck out of the relationship.
So with that in mind, you'll have to forgive me, I'm having a little bit of a problem with the system back here. With that in mind, if we've got unrealistic expectations that are propagated through this fantasy, that would imply that there's an industry that benefits from this, right? Divorce lawyers, yes, for one, but
yes,
there'd be... I mean, would there be an agenda there? Because if I tried to convince everybody of something that just wasn't true, and tried to get them all to do something that I know for a fact that they couldn't make work, I'd be sowing the seeds of destruction in the population, wouldn't I? Because I'd be placing a veil over people's understanding, and that would create chaos that I can come in and propose the solution to and be the beneficiary of that chaos in and of itself. Is that what's going on here? Like, how does that manifest?
Well, I'm not sure that the industry is malevolent. It's simply discovered a way that is, again, transcultural and transhistorical, that we buy into as human beings, because the message that they offer does seem to work in the first year or so of a relationship. And there is a particular attractiveness to the message that they're offering. There's a particular addiction and a beautiful high that we get from the beginning of a relationship. The problem is that there isn't a lot of conversation about sort of what to do next, and then so into the divorce lawyers and the separation space. As far as I can tell, our human species hasn't developed a library of information of what certainly heterosexual couples can do in order to come to an awareness, take the so-called red tablets, come to an awareness that that they've just gone through the honeymoon phase, and now there is a very rich and developmental stage ahead, where self-development invites us to become the next best version of ourselves and to bring that to our partner. So perhaps we're in the beginning stages of making that that exploration.
Okay. Continue.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, well, no, so, actually, we can't continue because we're coming off to a break.
Okay.
Perfect time to freaking leave it there, mate. We'll be right back after this, right, ladies and gentlemen. You listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show on Republic Broadcasting Radio. Don't you go anywhere.
I'm frustrated, yeah. Freedom won't make it, no.
I want the truth!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about having a happy birthday. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, and my very special guest, Paul Abramowitz, is breaking down the truth about sex and biology and monogamy. And now we're going to talk about that most interesting of topics, which I'm sure everybody is thirsting to hear about, pornography. The porn industry is massive at the moment, and what's interesting is that so many people watch it, and not everybody knows that pretty much everybody is watching it. Like, it's become so freaking pervasive in society now, and they're even talking about showing it to children. So let's get into that with Paul here. What's your take on the porn industry there, Paul?
Well, again, Vinny, the response to the porn industry, to my mind, strips back to our biological inclination, particularly as men, the inclination to be distracted and to find lots of different images of nude women exciting and interesting. So we can correlate that to dopamine surges in the brain, and we can understand too why it becomes extremely addictive. The predicament that we have as a society is, you know, I'm not sure how old you are, but you and I probably grew up with less access to steady stream of porn. There's lots of research to show that there's a lot of damage that happens to the values and the understanding of young men's interpretation of their own sex and sexuality. If they watch, for example, more women than in one night or two nights than their ancestors ever saw nude. The human brain is not really designed for that, certainly not a human brain that is looking to find some intimacy and happiness with a monogamous relationship. So to my mind, we're in a massive experiment right now, particularly kids who've grown up with the tablets in their hand, boys of 9, 10, 11, you know, watching porn, sharing selfies of themselves by the time they get to 14 or 15. What the outcome of that is that they struggle with erectile dysfunction when they get to sexually active age. And they also, because they've been watching pornography, which by the way is generally staged, it's an acting profession, the pornography becomes both their arouser and their teacher. And the problem is that when they bring what they see to their partner or to a new partner, it becomes often rather disinteresting. and sometimes disturbing. There are stories of you know, women being strangled, and not to death, but asphyxiated, because boys watch that and they think that that's really what women like. But the porn industry is set up to create a form of entertainment rather than a form of education. So that's my short take on the porn industry. It's not an ally if one is looking for proper intimacy, connection, communication, presence, all of those things that lead to more extraordinary sexual engagement with a partner.
Where do you find the place between communication and sex really is in a relationship that's monogamous? Where's the balance?
The balance between communication and sex.
Yeah, I mean, how much communicating do you need to do, and how much sex do you need to have? Is there a need for, you know?
Well, you definitely need to have sex in order to have communication. I assume you're talking about each partner communicating what their likes and dislikes are.
Mm.
That what you're talking about? Yes. So, once past the honeymoon phase, or even in the honeymoon phase, or even when partners are starting out together, it's good to have a space to communicate your experience and to be compassionate and understanding when doing that. And often not the place to do it is in the heat of the moment, unless something rather dire is happening in the heat of the moment. But to have a time outside of the bedroom where communication happens, you know, my love, what we tried last night, this was the impact on me. This was great. This was not, can we try it this way? There are masterful ways of learning communication around sexuality, because each of us will bring our own shame and guilt and secrecy to our intimate space. And so, you know, it's easy to get triggered in that space, because we're very vulnerable in that space. And so it's useful for couples to figure out where they want to have that conversation and how they want to have that conversation, and to give honest and clear feedback around what's working and, you know, what's not really working. But it is important communication, no doubt about it.
Mm. So when it comes down to relationships and how people are living them, is there an ideal that should be strived towards? Because you talked about taking that next level. And what I gathered from, I think, David Data's work, The Way of the Superior Man, is that women are non-temporal. It means they're without time. Okay, if you, for example, spent an entire week lavishing her with love and working really hard, and you're exhausted from it, and then you sit down and watch some TV, and she comes in and she's immediately angry with you because as far as she's concerned, that's all you're doing, and that's all you're ever going to do, and that's all you've ever done, because they don't see time like men do. Can you describe that? A dynamic?
Yeah, beautiful question. I think, again, it's good to go back to the concept of tendencies rather than generalizations, and say all women are or all men are this or that. I think it depends very much on the tendency of the woman that you're with, and to discover, you know, what it is, and not to make assumption based on the fact that she is in a female physiology that she's going to be a particular way. And that's why I like the word tendencies. The mastering or the next level of a heterosexual relationship is really about applying some curiosity to who the person is that you've become attracted to. What that means is that it means that we move beyond the original spark that happened, that may be changing by this time now, and that we begin to ask questions and to discover deeply who that person is, and hopefully she will also want to do the same with us. And so that requires a certain level of yielding, perhaps former secrecy that we've brought into relationships. It asks for a particular vulnerability and risk-taking. And that's where relationships start to become really exciting in a very different kind of a way. Because the next level of relationship is inviting both man and woman to step into a more senior place of masculine and feminine, or man and woman, out of the adolescent past ways that we've kind of made work in our past relationships, but haven't really, because we're not in them anymore. So it's a place of risk, a place of vulnerability, and a place of learning a different kind of communication. Because acknowledging that really we are quite different, men and women. And so, you know, gay relationships have the great benefit of sharing the same physiology. So there's a wonderful understanding between the couple immediately, and probably a very similar emotional background as well. So that's another beautiful synchronicity that gay couples will find. And I heard the other day on a podcast, and I need to check this out properly, but there's more difference between a man and a woman than there is between the human species and our closest chimpanzee from a DNA point of view. Okay, I'll just say that again because I see the surprise in your face. There's more difference between a man and a woman from a DNA point of view than there is between the human species and our closest chimpanzee. Now, when you consider the fact that heterosexual relationships require this difference to be entirely overlooked to some degree, or at least the kind of heterosexual relationships that have been sold to us up until this point, that actually we're basically the same, and therefore we should just get on with it, has been, to my mind, quite destructive, because couples would perhaps do well to know and to be curious about the differences, not to change the other person, but to seek what those differences are and to celebrate the differences and to find middle grounds so that the man-woman relationship can evolve to this place that you're asking about, which is the more evolved place. Because no, we're actually quite different.
How does that evolution take place? What is the work that needs to be done with the man and the woman to create that higher state?
So really it invites us to grow up, Vinny. Actually, it invites us to grow into adulthood. What does that mean? It means I must take responsibility for who I'm bringing into the relationship. It means I must be accountable for what I think might break this relationship up. It means that if necessary, I should be in therapy. It means that I shouldn't expect my partner to be my healer from that point of view. What does that mean? It means that she's not my therapist. It means that there is a space that I need to go into, either with mates of mine or in therapy space, so that I can go and work on those things, so that I can evaluate those things, so that I can leave the adolescent in a man's language, I can leave the frozen adolescent aspect of myself behind and begin to discover. And if she's up for it, she's going to support me in that place. She's going to support me, and I'm going to support her in that place. I'm going to support the wounds that she brings from her past relationships. And so, but she will also be working in an outside space so that both of us can bring our best possible versions to the relationship. And in that way, there's a state of being I like to call riding the spiral, where we're constantly moving upwards out of the loop of, you know, mundanity, which can grow in relationships. So certainly risk-taking, curiosity, and a willingness to grow into the man or the woman that we are longing to become. out of the codependent spaces that we've learned in adolescence.
In men, how does that personally manifest in terms of like a whole life rearrangement?
So what I found fascinating, Vinny, was that what I still find fascinating is that this conversation that I'm bringing in the book Sexed is a disappeared conversation, because if we look at all of the aspects that are looked at in leadership conferences and workshops, and you know, workshops where you pay $5,000 on a weekend and go and walk on hot coals and start to see your shadow, your Jungian shadow, and understand the hero's journey and all of those beautiful practices, the one missing piece out of all of that is the conversation around how does getting sexed as a man, how does my living in a sexual body actually impact my awareness? And what I came to discover through my own research is that there is an emotional sexual body that we take on as we come through puberty. Our emotional sexual body is drawn from, number one, the experiences that we have watching our parents in the home as a child. So we learn about intimacy or not. The second thing is that we develop a response to the great drive which meets us at puberty. And we respond to that by a number of factors which are present in most men. First of all, we develop a secrecy around our sexuality. That bleeds into all aspects of our lives. It can lead into business secrecy, relationship secrecy. We develop a degree of discipline and self-control, where so that there can be a shutting down of our emotional body or our ability to communicate verbally. And there's often a lot of shame and guilt affiliated with our sexuality, particularly, you know, if we're masturbating a lot as young boys. But what's not written about as well is an overarching vulnerability that we have as men around our sexuality. So in old classical writings, they would say the Oedipus complex or the mother complex is a vulnerable aspect of a boy, and the penis is a very strong, powerful aspect of the boy. But in actual fact, the penis is both strong, but it's also very vulnerable, because it carries with it a very powerful emotional sexual aspect, which hasn't yet been defined up until the moment that that I defined it in the book. So therapists are finding it very useful to know that this man sitting in front of them, particularly a woman therapist, has got this other aspect that is able to be harvested and archaeologized. And because it's such a central part of us, our sexuality, when you harvest these aspects that I've just mentioned, shame and guilt around sexuality, secrecy around sexuality, and a man can change these aspects, the whole world starts to change for us as men, because these are the central engine rooms of a lot of the shame and guilt in our lives, a lot of the secrecy in our lives, a lot of the vulnerability in our lives. When we look specifically at these aspects as sexual indices, a lot of change, positive change, happens for men, and changes in our relationship as well. We bring our best game to our relationships when we're able to do that, no doubt about it.
So a man goes from one set of behavior to the other set of behavior. What's that start and end point here in terms of his development?
Vinny, there's no end point. There's no end point, because if a man is passionate about developing, as passionate as he is about, let's say, making money or his children, if he's passionate about what I call the politics of one, which is our own inner orbit, then there really isn't a place where the journey stops. It stops when we take, you know, our last breath. But when the journey starts, it's easy to begin to see a change in the way that we see the world as a man. The way that the hologram looks back at us starts to change as we begin to understand ourselves more, and we begin to access this better part of ourselves, which we bring into our relationship. And believe me, a woman in her sensitive state tendency-wise, picks up on these things. And so there's a flourishing from a different place of this of the relationship, because very often there's nothing that can make a woman, you know, more pleased and more often turned on to find that certain habits and values and behaviors and beliefs are changing in their man. And then she's given the invitation to step up into her senior feminine, her senior way of being, her adult way of being, because she becomes more curious. And so there's this, you know, tennis match of curiosity backwards and forwards that begins to happen. And so there's this riding of the spiral once again, which moves a couple out of their mundane spaces, the old treaded spaces.
Do the men need to lead the way kind of like that? I mean, you can't just go to your woman, okay, you start changing this and then I'll start changing that. It has to be the men taking lead, yeah?
Spot on. Well, it can be anybody taking the lead. But you have to lead by example, Vinny. You got to, you know, put the work in yourself, whichever partner it is. And hopefully you're with a partner who's really keen to also develop and change. But it's not a place of shame and blame or I did this, you should do that. It's a different culture in a sense. It's a different culture of being. As I say, leading by example, by showing that you've got some skin in the game and that you're wanting to change and that you believe in the relationship and that you respect and love your partner. And, you know, that's part of the reason why the change is being instituted. And that's very inspiring. It's very inspiring for your partner.
Can you give an example through your work that kind of illustrates that?
Well, I'll use porn as an example, for example. I mean, very often couples come to me because the man has been struggling with porn for a long time. The woman feels, obviously, she can't compete against that. The man is unfulfilled in his intimacy space with her. He has erectile dysfunction. And that's a complete downward spiral. So oftentimes in that situation, I will work alone with the man and look at the tendency and the draw towards the porn, and then begin to work with the woman and try to excavate the feelings of distrust and the feelings of not good enough and all of those things so that we can bring them to the surface. And at that point, the couple is ready to come together and move beyond once the man has stopped with the porn and the woman feels trust coming back into the relationship. So that's very much a to and a fro, because the woman needs to regain her trust. She needs to understand that the man got into the porn cycle for a number of reasons that may actually have had nothing to do with her. It might have been relief of stress at work, for example, or boredom, or any number of reasons. And so once she sees that he is honestly trying to make good amends, she's ready to open herself vulnerably again. And the couple can move back into an intimate space away from, you know, where they came from. So that's one example. And by the way, not an uncommon example.
And what's your take of the MGTOW movement, men going their own way and sort of like swearing off women and things of that nature?
I just think everybody needs to do what they need to do, Vinny. There are a lot of men's organizations where, you know, men have found a great source of comfort and peace in being in the company of men alone. And that's great. If that's what gives them their quality of life. I don't think that there are particular heightened states of being that are beyond other states of being. I mean, people should do what makes them happy as long as they're not harming anybody. I can understand why men find those places comforting. I can also understand why women would find places where only women hang out comforting and safe. So that also exists, you know, by the way. So
do you see the in general that society with the advent of porn or social engineering as well, men and women, have we gotten better or worse? Just a quick answer. We're coming to the end of the show.
Better.
We have gotten better. All right. Well, that's a good note to leave it off on. Thank you so much for your time, Paul. Quickly, what is your website?
Website is www.sexed.global.
Sexed.global. Paul Abramowitz, thank you so much for your time today, brother. And thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in. I would advise you to go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. And go ahead, ladies and gentlemen, make a donation. And we'll see you again next time.